We have started a conversation around disruptive technology, specifically darkness technology that has spurred investors to drop millions of dollars behind electric scooters and bikes in recent weeks. Critics don't like the way the companies operate. They drop into town to create a demand for their product without getting proper regulatory approvals. Like it or not, it's a business model that communities across the globe are being forced to deal with. California is struggling with how it would work with its mandatory helmet law. And here at home, it remains to be seen what impact Lime will have on the local nonprofit bike-sharing program, Beaky Bikes. Back in May, the group's CEO, Lori McCartney, told us when it began talking with the city years ago, it considered two dockless systems, but that the city settled on the dock plan that's in place now. We caught up with Honolulu's mayor, Kirk Caldwell, as Lime tries to force the city to address its entry into the market.
The reason why the city and County of Honolulu got behind a, Beaky Bike and a docked approach was a way to control where the bikes are placed, because they would be using city assets, either sidewalks or streets. And where you put a docked station, you know that that's where the bikes will be placed, that's where they'll be returned, and they're being put in places where there's been some discussion and forethought, both with the city, but also with the community. And as you see, you know, in our expansion of Beaky, we are engaging with the community and talking about where the appropriate places to put the stations, and it can then control the impact in our neighborhoods. And that's why we went with this program. Now, after that, a Lime bike showed up in a very short notice without reaching out to the administration in any way, and rolled out about 200 Lime scooters, and we immediately saw the negative impact, the concerns we had when we went with the docked program, where scooters were left all over the place. One ended up in the Alawai Canal. Others were dumped in Kapi'olani Park, where, you know, when they operate them, they start making a profit, and you can't use the park for business purposes. And it resulted in our strong pushback and request that they remove the scooters and then sit down with us to talk about how we should proceed. Since that time, we formed a working group at the city, at the executive level, where we're working on the best model to roll out, because we recognize that whether it be Lime Bike or Jump or Verge or some of these other bike share, scooter share, electric bike kind of programs, they're going to come, just like they're going to other cities, not in our country, but around the world. But how do we manage it in such a way that we don't have more challenges to our sidewalks than we already have? And as you know, we have many, many challenges. And for me, and they have not made a recommendation yet, but I think we have to figure out a way where it's clear that whatever type of program it is, whether it be dockless or docked, that the bikes need to be returned to designated areas, or the scooters need to be returned to designated areas and not just left all over the place. And there's going to have to be some form of technology to incentivize that occurring. In a docked program, needs to be returned there, or you have trouble when you rent the bike. They're going to have to come up with some kind of app that, when the scooter is returned, it needs to be returned to a designated area, or it continues to charge the customer, for example. Perhaps that's one way to do it. The other issue is one of safety. These scooters, for the most part, were being driven on sidewalks at a high speed that, if it was to hit a pedestrian, they would cause significant physical harm. So to make sure they're not ridden on the sidewalks, in fact, Lime initially was showing how demonstrating the use of these scooters right on city sidewalks. So there's that issue. And then the second issue is, what is appropriate in a bike lane and what is not appropriate? And obviously, mopeds are not allowed in bike lanes. And some of these scooters are considered to be no mopeds, yet I would even say, as mayor, I don't think they're appropriate in the road either, because they don't look safe enough to be riding with cars. So how do we find this balance? And we're going to be looking at best practices in other cities and then coming out with regulation to work with these other types of companies to see what we can do.
We did talk with the Lime representative, who said that they did come up with a plan for best practices, and I think they may have already transmitted that to the administration. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it. Is it your sense that there will be some kind of pilot project?
It could be a pilot. You know, I'm not going to jump ahead and speculate yet because I've asked this group to come up with their recommendation. But I do think there will be a recommendation on how to manage this. You know, these types of companies are going to come to our shores, and I don't think we can keep them out any more than, you know, people would like to keep out Uber and Lyft will be kept out. And I think this is part of the new technology that's coming about around the world, and it's one that we should look to work with, but it's how you manage it appropriately. We've talked about some of these things, but I think their model is not a perfect model, and I think that it's going to need to be adjusted. But I think that is something we want to do holistically. So it's not just their model, but it's a model that would work for all the different types of bike companies or scooter companies that we have. I think we're going to see more of these types of companies, you know, backed with a lot of capital, that are going to be looking to try to grab market share in cities around our country. And there's particularly interest in our city, partly because of the strong visitor industry, but also we're well suited because of our flat terrain and in density within the urban core for using these types of bikes and scooters.
We were hearing some concern by seniors. They're just concerned that these things are just going to be scattered about and will create a hazard.
They are tripping hazards, and that's why we want to make sure they would be returned to designated areas in a standing position where they wouldn't be just dropped on their side. And we saw a lot of the drop-in on the side in the week that Lyme was here. They were on sidewalks, they were in bus stops, they were thrown, as I said, in the Holloway Canal. And they were also placed on private property with no permission from the private businesses, and that is something that would have to be worked out too. But yes, we want a program. We're trying to become an age-friendly city, and as you know, we had a summit a couple of years ago on it. We're rolling out parts of this. The bulb outs are part of that. But in becoming age-friendly, we don't want to see these kinds of programs where it's actually making it more dangerous for our seniors for trip and fall hazards.
Okay, so basically your message is not so fast.
Not so fast. And looking at it holistically, not just for one company, but for all competitors.
Since the city issued its cease and desist order and returned the scooters, Lyme has hired Glenawong's public relations company to help navigate the way going forward with the administration. That is in addition to 360 PR, which initiated talks with members of the Honolulu City Council. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, Microgrids 101. But first, we test you with our backyard quiz. For today's quiz, we delve into the family tree of Barack Obama. Lolo Satora, born in 1935 in what was then the Dutch East Indies, came of age during the tumultuous Indonesian National Revolution. An Asia Foundation scholarship allowed him to study at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, where he met and later married Ann Dunham and became the stepfather of the future president. His marriage to Dunham, whom he met at the East-West Center, lasted 15 years, during which they split their time between Honolulu and Sotero's native Indonesia. While young Barack enrolled at Punahou, Sotero remained in Indonesia to help the government map the uncharted territory of Western New Guinea. Dunham and Sotero divorced in 1980, while Sotero passed away 8 years later. Their shared education at the University of Hawaii is the subject of this program's backyard quiz. Can you tell us what was Lolo Sotoro's field of study during his education at the University of Hawaii? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
I'm Jude Hill from Kailua. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Microgrids, you might think of them as energy pods, small systems that could generate power in the event the larger grid fails for whatever reason. This morning, we talked to Lisa Loeffner, CEO and co-founder of Go Electric, a company that provides microgrid systems to commercial, industrial, and military customers in Hawaii and on the mainland.
What a microgrid is it is the ability to tap into an energy resource at your facility when the grid is gone. And, you know, and the grid could go away because of a lava flow, or it could, like in Puerto Rico, it could go away because of really extreme weather. Typically, your lights go out, and that can be incredibly frustrating for not only homeowners, but certainly business owners and factories and retail shops and fire departments. You know, everyone's business and lives pretty much are revolving around electricity. So if you think of an energy pod at your house or your business, if the grid goes out, there's some other energy resource that's right there at your facility that turns on and gets your power back up. For a lot of businesses, that can be a backup generator. In Hawaii, there's a lot of solar, so if you are, you do have that energy pod at your facility, you can keep your PV operating safely if it's installed in a microgrid. And then other energy resources can be maybe a wind turbine, it can be a flow battery or a fuel cell. Literally anything that produces or stores energy, all are great energy pods at your facility.
And what projects are you working on in Hawaii right now?
Go Electric was a microgrid provider for the Spiders Phase 3 microgrid. That's up at Camp Smith. That actually was commissioned back in 2016. And then we also put in a system at the Emergency Management Agency's headquarters at Diamond Head on Oahu. And then we have two other projects we haven't announced yet that are going in on two other islands in Hawaii. Generally, a microgrid is sized to whatever the load profile looks like at the building it's connected to. Because when the grid goes out and you go into a microgrid operation, you want to be able to cover the loads of the building, you know, just like the grid did before the grid went away. So it can be a small microgrid house size. It can be a very large microgrid. Camp Smith is about 5 megawatts total. It can be I'll call it a medium-sized microgrid for an individual high-rise, say a hotel with, you know, lots of air conditioners and lots of loads. So microgrids really vary depending on how big the building is. Hospitals and data centers especially have had them for a long time. You know, when the grid goes out, obviously hospitals want to keep all their patients alive, so they have had what's called a UPS, that's an uninterruptible power system, and a backup generator that's tied to their building, and it islands away from the grid, and that becomes its own microgrid, and the batteries and then the generator feed the loads from the hospital or the data center. So what we're Go Electric doing is we're pretty much making that same system available for any building, and we think that's important as Hawaii heads towards 100% renewable energy goal. Sometimes the grid might be kind of hard to manage, so having the ability to protect your loads, and with a microgrid, we think is a great solution to help Hawaii get towards that goal.
And I know we often hear that phrase, oh, yeah, I'm off the grid.
Well, a microgrid can be both grid connected when the grid is working, and it can be off the grid, or that's called grid islanded, either when the grid isn't working or if you just have the opportunity to be off grid and that's what you want, then you have a microgrid at your house or your business. But most of the time, microgrids are set up so they can be grid tied. And what's great about being grid tied is you can then help the grid with energy resiliency services like demand response, or you might be a generation resource for the grid if the grid wants to call you on that. But by staying grid tied, you're actually able to help the grid and help your building. If it's a single home, it's just a very small microgrid because most houses are, what, maybe 3 to 5 kilowatts. But a community would be a much larger microgrid. And yes, there are community microgrids that are demonstrating across the United States.
And is it the kind of thing where it's something that needs to be put in when the subdivision is being built, or can it come after the fact?
It can do both. If the subdivision is being built, then you're in the best position to go ahead and set it up for a microgrid. If the community is already in place and there's a single feeder going to it, it's actually pretty easy to set that feeder up to be able to island itself into its own community microgrid.
And what about the costs?
The cost is going to vary depending on what you all need to do to be able to separate from the grid into the microgrid. That involves a breaker, an electrical device that physically detaches all those houses from the grid, and that could be anywhere up to about $100,000 depending on how high of a voltage it is. And then you need to look at what kind of energy assets are available already at the buildings. If there are some backup generators and some PV already, then you may only need to have to add a microgrid controller to manage everything. At Camp Smith, they installed a full brand new microgrid. I think it was about just over 3 megawatts, and then they tied everything all together across the entire camp. That was a pretty big project, and lots of equipment went in, lots of work to get everything to go. So that was a pretty expensive project to be able to bring the whole camp off the grid. Microgrids can also provide resiliency back to the grid. So for example, one of the most common issues with the grid crashing is when there is too much load, you know, people coming home from work and turning on their air conditioners and their stoves. And so there's a mismatch between how much load is on the grid and how much energy is being produced by solar or power plants and stuff. And that it starts out as what's called a rolling brownout, and then eventually it turns into a blackout. With a microgrid, you can have your microgrid controller automatically sense when the grid is starting to get a little wonky, and then it can separate from the grid. You know, so the microgrid now is all islanded. It's on its own. You're not connected. And what that does is all of those loads that are in your microgrid now are no longer on the grid because they're self-supporting itself in the microgrid. Well, that immediately helps to unstress the grid. So having microgrids in place can not only protect the facilities or the homes with energy resiliency, but just the act of islanding away from the grid when the grid starts to get stressed will in turn actually help the grid start to heal itself.
Lisa Loeffner of Go Electric says Hawaii is one of 3 states leading the country with this concept of microgrids and improved resiliency. California and New York are the other 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui and Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
It's now time for the Reality Check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Today there's a story about empowering the Micronesian community. Reporter Suban Lee joins us this morning. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I thought your story was really fascinating, you know, that you actually found this out in our community. Tell our listeners about it.
Thank you, Catherine. Yeah, sure. So the story is about, it's really a candidate story, but it involves the issue of how to engage Micronesian American youth. Of course, this is an emerging group here. There's a large number of Micronesians in Hawaii. So it's really about a first-time candidate running for District 30 that includes the Kalihi neighborhood in the heart of Honolulu. The candidate's name is Sunny Ganadin, and he's challenging incumbent Romy Kachola, who's held office, the state office, since 2010. So what Sunny's doing is going out into the community and learning who lives out there, learning who his constituents are and what their issues are. And what he's doing is also engaging these Micronesian American youth, who many of whom are still too young to vote, but they're born here. And unlike their parents, you know, having that birthright citizenship comes that eligibility to vote once they turn 18. So what he's doing is really trying to get out there and talk to them and discuss the importance of one-day voting and being engaged with the community, because, of course, with community engagement comes more representation of how they can be better served in Hawaii.
Now, was this a group that just normally was comprised of a large cross-section of Micronesian students, or was it targeting that group?
The Micronesians in Hawaii, they're comprised of many different individuals from the islands in the Pacific. So they come from Chuuk, from the Marshall Islands, from Pohnpei, from Yap. There's very many different, you know, ethnicities clustered within this group. But under the Compact of Free Association, you know, many of their parents came under that treaty. It's a treaty between the United States and some of those nations, which allow them to come to the U.S. to work and live without a visa. So what you're seeing is an emerging generation of Micronesian American youth who are U.S. citizens.
And it's interesting because, you know, obviously their parents can't vote, but planting the seed early on and getting to know that community, it's kind of a smart thing to do for this candidate.
I think it is. Certainly, it's a very conscientious decision, or just I think effort, a recognition rather, that these youths are potentially Hawaii's next big voting bloc. In addition to, you know, youths of many different other backgrounds and ethnicities here, not to say that they don't count as well, but again, his district is District 30, which includes Kalihi, which is a very, very high concentration of Micronesian families. There are others in Hawaii, of course, but Kalihi does include many Micronesian folks. And so this effort is really intended to reach out to those who don't necessarily have a voice here, who won't necessarily be contacted by those who hold higher office. And I think that that's important to recognize that they too live here, that they also contribute to our economy and to our community, and that instilling this importance of voting is important from an early age.
Right, and I know being out in the field, I know homelessness is a big issue. There are lots of homeless Micronesians, but interesting that they can maybe advocate for their parents. Thank you. Thanks very much, Suban.
Thank you.
That was reporter Suban Lee from Honolulu Civil Beat. You can read her full story at civilbeat.org.
On the next Fresh Air, writer and critic Michael Arsenault talks with Terry about growing up in Houston, black, Catholic, and gay, and learning not to suppress who he was.
why would I do that? Like, what sense does that make to me?
His new memoir is I Can't Date Jesus, Love, Sex, Family, Race, and Other Reasons I've Put My Faith in Beyonce. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
Hawaii Public Radio hosted a political forum featuring the 1st Congressional District last night. Our news director, Bill Dorman, joins us this morning with how it went.
Yeah, interesting time. We had five Democratic candidates for the CD1 race. Don Mercado Kim was sick and couldn't make it. But the others, wide-ranging discussion covering a number of topics. Race, of course, for the seat occupied by Colleen Hanabusa, challenging David Ige for governor. Number of issues where the candidates agree, but there are also differences. Former Congressman Ed Case, the front runner in the race, talked about why he wants to go back to Capitol Hill.
I'm running because I believe that our government is broken, and I believe that we've got to start to fix some of our problems as opposed to just yelling and screaming at each other. I think we need to have a more solution-based approach to our problems, and I think we need to attack all of the issues in our country from that perspective. I also believe that we need a very, very strong team in Washington, and I believe I can lend my experience to our delegation there to keep things going for Hawaii.
You hear that little bell in the background, knowing that time is running out. But that theme of a broken government really echoed by a number of the candidates. Doug Chin, currently lieutenant governor, was state attorney general, among other positions. He also talked about trouble in Washington, and he talked about it in terms of what he called his nightly meditation on three points.
Don't become cynical about what I see around me. Don't become numb towards what's happening in the country. And then finally, always hope for a brighter future. When my parents came to the United States, they had nothing. They had all they had was just simply the same hope that they would be able to give their kids a brighter future.
Beth Fukumoto, been in the state legislature since 2013. She talked about generational change and the importance of drawing in a younger base of voters.
Right now, Hawaii is in the process of losing an entire generation because we have not done enough to fix things like affordable housing, to make our infrastructure better, to make our electricity cheaper. We haven't done enough, and there have been plenty of people that have had plenty of time to do that, and they haven't, which is why I'm running for Congress. We need somebody in Washington that's still close to those issues that are facing us, that still understands how important it is that we make things livable and affordable here in Hawaii.
You know, that idea of affordability, common one, again, for many of the candidates. Kaniela Ng also talked about that. He's been in the legislature since 2012. Clearly, he's trying to position himself as the most progressive candidate in the race and certainly eager to confront Republicans in Congress.
Let's stop getting had by Republicans and start leading with an affirmative vision. So when we're saying, like restore net neutrality, we should go bolder than that. We should say public broadband, high speed across the nation. We shouldn't just say protect ACA. We should say Medicare for all now. And not just affordable housing, but housing for all. If we can afford $30 million condos in Kaka'ako, we can afford to house all of us here in Hawaii. Scarcity is a political choice. We need the will to take it.
You hear that bell again. Honolulu City Council Chair Ernie Martin said confrontation sometimes needed, but also so is cooperation. And as an example, he talked about the early days of rail financing, talked about getting bipartisan cooperation in Congress for federal money. And he also said that just because Donald Trump is president, that doesn't mean government help grinds to a halt.
Donald Trump is just an individual person who just speaks his mind, doesn't necessarily represent the interests of the federal agencies that are involved. Classic example, I mean, with the recent flooding relief that was granted by FEMA. You know, there was some fear that Donald Trump would not release those funds, but at the end of the day, the federal government, they're going to do their job. It's a matter of asking the right questions and knowing where the resources are.
Wayne Yoshiak is going to have a little more analysis later this afternoon on All Things Considered at 5:30, but certainly a lively evening.
Yeah, we understand that the candidates took their turns ganging up on the front runner.
Yeah, you know, this is tradition in forum when you have multiple candidates. It's sort of who's out in front. An unusual thing with Hawaii, because there are so few polls, it just, one poll comes out and then that becomes the, what everybody reacts to.
Okay, all right. Bill Dorman, thanks for the update.
You bet.
Tomorrow kicks off the Conservation Alliance Conference at the Hawaii Convention Center. It's the 25th year of the gathering and comes on the heels of the International Congress, where Hawaii's efforts were put on a global stage. Sam Ohugan is with the Nature Conservancy. He's just back from Paris, where he gave a talk sharing Hawaii's story and the lessons learned over 1,000 years of sustainability.
The Hawaiian Islands are an amazingly special place, you know, going everything from sea level up to snowbound 14,000 feet, and from places that rival the driest places on Earth to arguably the wettest spot on Earth, and everything in between. And so when you think about that, the Hawaiian Islands aren't your typical just low sandy island with palm trees. It actually represents a microcosm of the entire planet, at least the terrestrial side of things. You can find plants and animals from anywhere on Earth could probably find a niche in the Hawaiian Islands somewhere. So with that kind of ecological richness, it's no wonder that the cultural richness of the indigenous culture of Hawaii that developed here would be equally rich. I mean, Hawaii is looked at as the epitome of development of, say, kapa, or of featherwork, or various other elements of Polynesian arts. And that is in large part due to the immense richness of the ecosystems that we have in the Hawaiian Islands that was able to support such a rich cultural and societal development.
And you use an analogy of our landmass compared with other places and the diversity that we have here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you think about the numbers of ecosystem types that we have, major life form categories, they're called in one of those classifications. Brazil, which is a huge, largest country in the continent of South America, runs like 40 degrees of latitude and goes everywhere from the foothills of the Amazon in of the Andes, rather, into the Amazon basin. And you look at that place as like a storehouse of biological diversity and ecological diversity. And it has 17 of the 38 ecosystem life zones that are in one major world classification, whereas Hawaii is much, much smaller than that, right? Instead of millions of square kilometers, we're tens of thousands of square kilometers and just cover 4 degrees of latitude, and yet we have something like 27 or 28 of the 38 world life zones present in the Hawaiian Islands. It's one of the most ecosystem-rich places on Earth. So, you know, when you have that much diversity jam-packed into a small area, then when you think about the tens of thousands of acres that have been lost to, say, monocrop agriculture or to just urbanization or the various other processes that occurred largely after Western discovery, then we can see why the Hawaiian Islands is like the endangered species capital of the United States. You start off with small area and great richness within that area, which means that any small portion of it, you know, 10% of it is lost, then all of the species that go along with that 10%, say, of the lowlands would also be lost.
And that designation to me is so sad.
Yeah, you know, it's a very depressing story if you choose to be depressed by those kinds of things, but despite those losses, there's much that remains, and it's our job to celebrate what's left and to make sure that we know about it and can protect it.
And so your work with the Nature Conservancy and then this upcoming conference, it really kind of underscores why we need to take steps to protect what we've got.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, we wouldn't have a Hawaii Conservation Conference attended by 1,000 delegates, you know, in professions, everything from students to teachers to professional managers to national park folks and private organizations such as the Nature Conservancy or even Kamehameha Schools or the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. There are 25 different organizations that together form the Hawaii Conservation Alliance. And that alliance is dedicated to the protection of Hawaii's biological diversity and ecosystem richness, land and sea. And together we host the Hawaii Conservation Conference. This is one of the main things that we do. But, of course, that is a reflection of the general idea that we can do much more together than we can separately.
And we're just coming off the big international congress.
yes, it's been a while now, right? In another 2 years or so, it will be held again. And it was held in 2016 at the very same convention center that this Hawaii Conservation Conference is being held. We forged a lot of really important international connections, not only with island nations in the Pacific and elsewhere, but just in general. The 10,000 delegates that attended that, and the, it was like every single nation except three, I think, attended that World Conservation Congress. And they all stepped away saying that Hawaii did an amazing job hosting this Congress, and that it was the most well-attended and the most successful Congress ever held in the history of the IUCN.
Yeah, that is amazing. So, and I know when you were in Paris, how were you able to kind of convey to the people who attended just what we're doing here and what a special place it is where we live?
Well, in giving my presentation, it was an introduction to many of them about the ecosystem richness in Hawaii and the species that we have and protect and need to manage. And Maile was one of those examples of something that may not be endangered, but is of immense cultural importance. And it just was one example of the reasons why Hawaiian conservation is so important. Our very culture, our very lifestyle, in fact, our well-being as people in a limited island system, just the protection of watershed forest alone that supplies our water. Those kinds of messages were probably new to others, right? They think of Hawaii as a place to go on vacation, enjoy a resort, and then come back home again. They have very little awareness of what the real story is in the Hawaiian Islands.
And we who live here are fortunate enough to understand the depth and the beauty of what these islands offer the world, really.
Sure. And, you know, the thing is that more and more people are becoming aware of these things. When you think about it, 20 years ago, people weren't planting native plants. They probably didn't even know what a native plant was. They would consider plumeria or bird of paradise or things like that as representative of Hawaii. And now more and more people are cognizant of the fact that we have our own special plants and animals that can only be found in the Hawaiian Islands and are really important to our lifestyle, our culture, and our well-being. So that kind of awareness just needs to grow continually, and that's why the Hawaii Conservation Conference, which is open to students and to the public, even on one of the days, for the most part, you register to attend the conference, but there is one day where it's opened up and people can come in and take a look at the displays and get a feel for what's going on, get a pulse of progress in conservation.
And is there an overarching theme this year?
Yeah, the overarching theme is due to the fact that this now represents something like, gosh, is it the 25th conference that we've had and the 30th year that the Hawaii Conservation Alliance has been in existence? And so the theme is Ulu Kalala Ike Kumu, which is an olelo no eo. It's a Hawaiian proverb. Ulu Kalala means the branch grows, Ike Kumu, from the trunk of the tree. That is, you know, when you plant a tree and it grows, you're lucky if it survives. If it survives and branches out and flowers, you get this amazing growth, right? It's a symbol of growth. And so it's a chance for us to demonstrate where we came from in conservation and the kind of progress we've made over the years. Just looking at the numbers of organizations that are in the Hawaii Conservation Alliance, and when we started, we didn't have Kamehameha Schools and the Office of Hawaiian Affairs there. But now that we recognize how important and how those organizations recognize how important conservation is to the very cultural foundations of Hawaii, they are now active members of the Hawaii Conservation Alliance.
That was Sam Ohugan, senior scientist with the Hawaii Nature Conservancy, setting the stage for this week's conservation conference. We have more about it coming up, but first we check in with Dave Lawrence and Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at the massive universe around our tiny planet. Also, what we can try and spot in our dark island skies. Christopher Phillips has the information. We're so grateful for his expertise and that he's on the line with us right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars in the east, Saturn in the south, and Jupiter in the southwest just after sunset. The moon this week will be approaching its full moon phase, so stargazing for those faint satellites and meteors in the heavens will be very challenging.
And this week, you've got some information relating to the NASA spacecraft Juno and its mission to explore the moons of Jupiter?
Yes, Juno has been conducting a study of the giant planet and its immense system of moons in an ongoing quest to expand our understanding of what makes Jupiter and its moons tick. Recently, Juno concentrated its suite of scientific instruments on the moon Io, the most volcanically active body in the solar system. Juno was able to image Io in infrared and detect hotspots on the surface. The images it obtained are spectacular.
So what'd they find?
Well, imaging in infrared allows us to detect sources of heat on and below the surface of this moon, and Juno painted a dramatic picture of a moon that is in constant geological turmoil, covered in volcanoes. Juno was able to count at least 150 active volcanoes, although we suspect this number may be as large as 400, including some brand new hotspots beneath the surface.
And how did this small moon get to be so active with all these volcanoes?
Well, tiny Io is a victim of Jupiter's brutal gravitational shear. As the moon orbits the planet in its elliptical orbit, it's subject to vast changes in gravitational forces. And basically, the tiny moon gets squeezed and then pulled apart ever so slightly. And all this stress generates enormous amounts of heat in the interior, which manifests itself as volcanoes.
Sounds like Juno's doing some cool science out there. How long is the mission set for, Chris?
Well, the spacecraft is set to sail amongst Jupiter and its moons till at least 2021, which means, of course, that we can expect some fantastic science over the next 3 years, and hopefully some further insight into what lies beneath the surface of Jupiter's impenetrable clouds.
And hopefully we'll have that information from you here. It's Christopher Phillips. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer. We also keep it on demand at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary. Architects for the Culinary Institute of the Pacific, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
From 1965 to 1980, Indonesian geographer Lolo Sotoro was the stepfather of America's 44th president, Barack Obama. Like many in the extended family of the former president, Sotoro's path at one point brought him to the Hawaiian Islands. In the turmoil following the Indonesian National Revolution, Sotoro was admitted to the University of Hawaii at Manoa. There he met the future president's mother and another notable UH alum, Ann Dunham. Dunham, who at the time was there for her BA in anthropology, met Sotoro at the campus's East-West Center, and with the year, the two were married. For today's backyard quiz, we asked listeners to tell us what Sotoro studied during his time at UH Manoa. The answer? Geography, a study that would greatly benefit Sotoro in his later career. In 1966, he was sought by the Indonesian government to map parts of the largely uncharted region of Western New Guinea. And in 1970, he fathered a daughter with Dunham, Maya Sotoro Ng, who teaches today at the very same university where Sotoro earned his degree. And congratulations, we have a winner, Sonia Bigalki Bannon from Honolulu, got it right. That is today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This weekend, HPR reporter Kuvei Hirashi spent some time with a couple of groups who'll be featured at the upcoming Conservation Alliance Convention. She joins us live in the studio to tell us about her experience out in Waimanalo this weekend.
Yes, aloha, Catherine. Thanks for having me. I joined the folks over at Ealapu, and this is a network of stewardship-based community organizations that gather every year. And these guys work on things like fishpond restoration or taro cultivation. And oftentimes, these organizations will operate in silos, so they're not aware of what other folks are doing. But the a big time, or most of the time, the biggest issues that they deal with are some of the same things: sea level rise, overdevelopment, stream diversions. So this year, Waimanalo hosted the annual gathering. And for anyone who's worked in this line of work, when you have hundreds of free labor sort of volunteers coming into town, you really want to take advantage of that. And so that's what Waimanalo did. They restored a portion of the rock wall enclosure near Kayona Beach Park. So for anyone who's familiar with the Waimanalo shoreline, this is all the way over by Sea Life Park, sort of by the Shriners Beach Club or the Magnum PI House. There's this rock wall enclosure fronting those homes, and oftentimes it's mistaken for a fish pond. But we actually have Waimanalo resident Luana Albino talking about what that enclosure really is.
Pahonu is a pond built by Kui Kui for his wife, Pahonu. Kui Kui was the high chief, Kahuna, and he liked to eat turtle. So the Maka'ainana made him this pahonu. And nobody else could eat the honu. He's very stingy. Only for him.
Yeah, so Auntie Luana saying pahonu is basically just an enclosure for turtles. And that was their little ice box, if you will.
Interesting.
It was. And so the group restored a portion of the wall closest to Sea Life Park, or the Makapu'u side, which, according to Albino, had not been done since 1960. So having that influx of labor into Waimanalo was huge, and being able to do that. And collective impact is really one of the big themes in this E'alupu network. So this network started 15 years ago to really kind of have, really realize that true strength in numbers of manpower, but also in being able to exchange best practices on how to best deal with things in their respective communities. But when you go to these things, they're like the who's who of conservation groups. So, you know, as a reporter, it's like a treasure trove of ideas, but it's also an opportunity to really put your finger on the pulse of the community to see what they're really going through. And so I was able to talk to the folks who came in from Kauai. As you know, back in April, Kauai's North Shore was pummeled by heavy rains from Hanalei to Haena. So I was able to catch up with Haena resident Presley Wan, who runs one of the stewardship organizations out there, about what they're going through right now.
What we're going through right now is flood recovery. We got a flood event of 50 inches in one day. And that's like, it was like of biblical proportions, you know. So we're still in recovery mode. The community is very, very resilient.
That's right. Juan's organization, Hui Maka'aina no Makana, was instrumental in establishing the first community-based subsistence fishing area. So this, if for people who aren't familiar with that, it's basically like a set of rules with catch limits and methods of fishing in certain areas are restricted. So an example for Haena, which is interesting, is there's no night fishing. So there's no, unfair competition for the fish. But the idea is to restore the fishing populations in the area. And it's the first of its kind here in Hawaii. And it happened in large part because of this network. So they were able to talk to other fishing communities across the state. They're all going through the same thing. And they were able to figure out how to bring those fishing populations back. And he was, it was interesting, Juan was saying that this actually had an impact, the disaster did, on the bouncing back of the fishing populations.
In one way, this is a blessing. It's a chance for the place to heal. You know, we were getting 2,000 to 3,000 people a day. You know, it's like almost 1 million people, tourists, coming to Haena in a year, you know. And didn't seem to have any, check and balances as far as the amount of, you know, impact that it was having.
That's right. So the one road in and out of Haena is still closed to local traffic, which is sometimes a headache for folks. But it's been going for 3 months now, and he says it's actually helping.
It's a silver lining. It's really what it is.
It's interesting to watch these communities go through these disasters, whether it's the lava flow or this flood, and learning from those particular communities on how to move forward.
Right, because I know the concern there was that they were getting so many people there. Like, I think, I forget what it is,
a thousand a day,
and they were trying to limit it and cap it to at least 800 or something much lower, because it's just out of control.
Exactly, and I think this is that opportunity to sort of wipe that slate clean and figure out in the rebuilding process how much of an impact they really want to have on the community there.
Right, right. So the give Mother Nature a rest.
Exactly. And the other organizations that are there, it's interesting to watch them sort of chime in to see, okay, I'm going through this too. How did you guys deal with it? Help us.
Okay, we'll look forward to your stories all week.
Sounds good. Mahalo.
All right. That was Kuvehi Hiraishi spotlighting one of the many interesting issues that will be covered in the conference. It kicks off tomorrow. Again, look for her stories on HPR later this week.
I'm Marco Werman. When it comes to news, summertime is not the slow season.
I think the Russians need to know that there are a lot of us who fully
look at the sanctions I put on. Look at the diplomats I threw out. Look at all of the things that
being a Russian analyst has become being a Trump analyst, something that I'm less skilled at than understanding Russia.
Big stories and small surprises, too. That's the world.
This afternoon at 1.
We do have to go, but up tomorrow, why the service dog law is making some people nervous. We would like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments about what you heard today. Think those electric scooters are a good thing or a bad thing? Would they work on your island? Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or go to our Facebook page and post comments or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you miss part of this show or want to check a past one, go to the Conversation page. We have links to more information. Just look under HPR News and Talk for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of the Conversation.